Wisconsin Public Radio. This is Newsmakers. I'm Ezra Wall in our studio on the campus of the University of Wisconsin La Crosse. We're talking about racial justice today, in particular a workshop that is being presented by the YWCA in La Crosse. We'll talk about what the workshop will contain. We'll talk to a couple of the facilitators of that workshop, and we'll help you learn how you can participate if that's something that you want to do. First, let me welcome my guests. We have Rebecca Schwartz, who's the Mission Impact Coordinator for the YWCA of La Crosse. Rebecca, thanks very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Happy to be here. Thanks for the invitation.
And Tracy Littlejohn is a racial justice facilitator with the YWCA and has done that for several years now, and is also a youth coordinator with the Ho-Chunk Nation in La Crosse and is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation herself. Tracy, thank you very much for joining us on Newsmakers.
Sure. It's great to be here, Ezra. Thank you.
We can talk. I definitely want to talk about like the specific things that people can expect to experience when they show up to the workshop, and we'll do some of that down the road. But just in broader strokes, Rebecca, why is racial justice such an important aspect of work for the YWCA to get involved in at this point in history?
Well, that's a great question. And actually, the best answer to that is it's central to our mission. The mission of the YWCA National and here in La Crosse is to eliminate racism, empower women. And so racial justice workshops are central to that mission and making sure that it happens here in our community.
It's become an issue of attention across our country. I mean, it's been getting a lot of attention for a long time, and partly because there are periods when not a lot of progress is made and all that, but especially in the last couple of years, we've heard a lot about racial justice and seen people increasing efforts toward that end and engaging in workshops and different things. And yet, it's one wonders for something that's been such an important issue for so long. How do we know when it's finally going to make a difference? I don't even know if that's a fair question to tackle just in one show. But Rebecca, how do you know when materials available like this and opportunities like this are beginning to make a difference?
That's a great question. Well, we definitely have a heightened awareness of the racial injustices and disparities that we experience, not just locally, but nationally. And so, you know, workshops like ours definitely get a little more attention during these times. But, we've been working on getting the workshop out to the community, you know, for the last several years. And I think to answer your question about when will we see success, I know I have lots of ideas about what that might look like. But really, it's our communities of color that get to answer that question and tell us, you know, as a white woman, I don't experience racism. I think we're all impacted by racism, but I don't experience racism as a white person. But it is my job to work on it, to work on it in our community, and to work on it when it shows up in my own life. And I think these workshops are a great opportunity for all of our community members to look at, what does racism look like in our community? What is each of our roles in dismantling racist systems and confronting it when it shows up in our spaces? And as far as when that work is done, I'm not the one to answer that.
Tracy Littlejohn is here as well. And Tracy is a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation and a youth coordinator with the Ho-Chunk, and a facilitator with the YWCA of this workshop that we're talking about today. So, Tracy, in your involvement with these workshops in the past and opportunities like this, how do you think the message has been received by people? Do you think I don't know how we could even tell whether progress is being made. It's certainly not in leaps and bounds, but do you see people moving in the right direction?
I see that there has been some improvement. There have been some changes, but that's how it's been, you know, for 100 years or more. There's little steps being made. So, you know, I can say things are better for me than they were for my dad, They may be better for my son than it always has been for me. But unfortunately, to be realistic, I think it's going to be a couple more generations, if not more, before we really see real equity and inclusion and a anti-racist country. I wish it could move faster. But I do have some optimism for lacrosse because we are seeing a lot of people that have gone through this training, and I have conversations with them afterwards, and I can see that the change. I can see that they want to make a difference because we're helping them to understand things a little better, that rather than just don't be racist. That's not going to work. We have to get people to really think and reflect on so many things before we can actually start to see some changes happening.
You talked about hopefully things being better for you than for your father, and hopefully passing a world to your child that is better than the one that you grew up in. What does racial justice look like for you?
For me, there's so many different facets to it depending on which community you're coming from. For me, as an Indigenous person, I need to see some type of reconciliation, some type of apology and acknowledgement of everything that has been done to the Indigenous people of the Americas, the colonization of, from the French, the English, the Spanish. Whereas for African American community, it could be something different where it is, and I don't like speaking for them, but it may look more familiar as, making sure that they are not having these gaps in wages. There aren't the achievement gaps in education. When it comes to the Hmong community, it may be acknowledgement, it may be a reduction in the expectation of assimilation to be American. It has many different faces for different people.
So in terms of in terms of what you're interested in teaching, who's the primary audience for this racial justice workshop? I don't know who wants to tackle that first. Maybe Rebecca. When you at the YWCA, when you envisioned this racial justice workshop, who's the intended audience for it?
The workshop's open for the general public. So while we've been offering the workshop to organizations sort of as a word of mouth for several years, the workshop that's coming up is it's open to the general public. All are welcome to come and have this learning experience. But knowing that we live in a predominantly white Western European community, we know that white folks are going to likely be the predominantly largest group in that space. And historically, when we do these workshops, that's who's there. And so it's an opportunity for people in our community to talk about race and racism in a way that we aren't used to, where we center the experiences of communities of color in that conversation. And that actually goes into a little bit about the workshop. But I know we're talking about lots of things here, so I don't want to get ahead of myself.
Well, you talked about centering the experiences of people who experience racism as we're talking about it, and yet this is going to be it brings up a sort of a semantic challenge when you start using words like racism and defining them, because a lot of people will come and say, I've experienced someone who has expressed prejudice toward me in some kind of way. That's racism, isn't it? And
I'm so glad you asked.
yet in this context, that isn't what you're talking about when you say racism, is it?
No, you're absolutely right. So while we obviously acknowledge that individual prejudices can experience, anybody can experience that. When we say racism and when we talk about it in the workshop, we're talking about institutional racism ultimately. So the combination of institutional power combined with that prejudice or unconscious bias or conscious bias to impact a larger community, not just that one-on-one interpersonal piece. So we're really more interested in helping people who work in systems, have an impact on our larger community, take a look at where do I fit in this community? Where are the places that I make decisions and have power to affect my community? Kind of looking at the root of institutional change. I don't know if Tracy has anything to offer on or add on that.
Tracy, what are your thoughts on that? We were talking about racism, not as an individual prejudice, but as something that society has set up as a means of retaining power.
Yeah, that is really what our program at its core is trying to get people to learn and understand, accept, and then do what they can to change it. Because it's the system that often affects the opinions and beliefs and values of people. And sometimes it is a racist value. And then that trickles down to how people interact individually. So if we can attack things at the core, that will make the differences. You may still have people who are going to have those racist beliefs. But if we've got all of these different other systems in place that are anti-racist, those few misguided individuals are not going to have the power that they perceive that they have. To have that equity and that inclusion for people of color is really, that's what we want to see. It's not, it isn't like some people fear that, oh, people of color are going to take over everything and we're going to be left in the dust. No, sorry, we know that's not going to happen. But we just want the same opportunities. We don't want the hurdles there. We want the historical policies that have made today what it is to not be factors anymore in how we are able to achieve and have opportunities in life.
You used a term before, anti-racism, and I think a lot of people would freely acknowledge that they're not pro-racism. What does it mean to be specifically anti-racist to you?
For me, being anti-racist is to want to see a world, a community, where people actively reject racist values and beliefs. That's kind of like the simplest definition I can give you.
I'm thinking about your experience as a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation, because we live on land that was originally inhabited by your people. My house is on land that was originally inhabited by your people. The streets that I walk on, drive down, the sidewalks that I walk on, the parks that I go visit, were all inhabited by Ho-Chunk people long before my Norwegian forebears ever crossed the ocean. And yet when you look at our society as it's currently set up, not only Ho-Chunk people, but other indigenous, members throughout our whole country have such a small seat at the table of authority over how our country operates at the moment. And I wonder, like, how we can make progress in terms of racial justice. Does that progress necessarily involve creating a bigger seat at the table for people like the Ho-Chunk Nation or like African Americans whose forebears were brought here against their will? How do we accomplish something like that?
Well, we definitely need to have those seats at the tables, but more importantly, we need for people to be able to understand what has happened, to know the histories. So many people really don't know much about the history in the United States of what has happened to Native Americans. A lot of people that live right here in La Crosse don't realize that we had villages here. There are burials here. There were mounds here. There's so a lot of significance in La Crosse for the Ho-Chunk people that so many people here just don't know. And if we're able to get to a point where people learn this stuff and they're aware of it, we don't necessarily always have to be at the table. We're going to have people who have the abilities and the values and those anti-racist beliefs to be able to make decisions that are inclusive.
That's Tracy Littlejohn, a youth coordinator with the Ho-Chunk Nation and a facilitator of the upcoming YWCA workshop on racial justice. And also today, talking to Rebecca Schwartz, who's the Mission Impact Coordinator for the YWCA in La Crosse. We're going to take a quick time out. If you'd like to hear part of this conversation again or a previous episode of our program that you might have missed, you can find them all on our website, wpr.org/newsmakers. We're continuing in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio. It's Newsmakers on Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Ezra Wall in WPR's Southwestern studios here in La Crosse. Thank you very much for joining us for a conversation about racial justice. We're in particular talking about a racial justice workshop coming up August 30th through September 1st, and it is being put on by the YWCA in La Crosse. Two guests joining us who are both involved in making that workshop go: Rebecca Schwartz, who's a Mission Impact Coordinator for the YWCA, and Tracy Littlejohn, who is a racial justice facilitator with that organization and also a youth coordinator with the Ho-Chunk Nation. And so, turning our attention to the specifics of the three-day workshop, now you've got it broken down into topics, being racial identity development. The second topic is deconstructing racism, and then the third topic is exploring privilege. Rebecca, what can people expect to experience when they show up for the workshop on August 30th?
Well, the workshop occurs over 3 days, beginning on August 30th. So three whole days, 24 hours of an in-depth and interactive dialogue and learning experience around racial justice. The whole first day is devoted towards sort of an introspective personal reflection on one's own racial identity formation. How do I walk through the world? How does race and culture, show up in my life? What does that look like for me? So we spend a lot of time delving into what that means that first day. So it's very introspective. And then the second day is a deep dive into history. And one of the things I love about our workshop is a lot of thanks to Tracy, got a lot of research on hyper-local history, talking about the experiences of communities of color here in La Crosse. And we often hear in our post surveys that people really enjoy that historical perspective, sort of how did we get to where we are today? We can't really figure out where we're going or address the issues of today until we kind of understand how we got here. And so we take a whole second day to unpack that. And then that third day, I almost want to change the name to exploring both power and privilege. So we understand, what does it mean to have privilege? And then looking at what can I do? How can I take action steps now that I've learned all this stuff? What can I do with it? And that's where that personal power and institutional power conversation happens, is in that third day. And I don't want to give away too much of the workshop, mm-hmm. Cause I said it's interactive. It's, and a lot of interpersonal, conversation happens.
So in terms of facilitating the workshop, Tracy, you're one of several different facilitators who are an active part of putting this three-day educational event on. Do you have a specific area of expertise that you're going to be addressing?
The history part really is my favorite. I really like the history part. We also go over like biases and microaggressions, and I kind of like the microaggressions part. But really, it is the history. We have adapted our curriculum from the original that came out of the YWCA in Madison by Colleen Butler. So we've adapted it a lot for La Crosse because their demographics are different. Some of the data needed to be, updated. And I think each of us has our favorite sections of the program. I wish nobody really wants to sit through more than 3 days. I wish I could have more than 3 days, because while it seems like that's a lot of time, we really are just scratching the surfaces on a lot of it. And it's going to depend on the participants to carry on what they're learning from it. But the dialogue between all of the participants is really the key to why this one is so different and unique, and I think more effective than some other trainings might be.
Rebecca talked about how this presentations like this have been done not just in this public setting where anybody can sign up and come to it, but also in like a corporate setting or for a group of people who have who are offering this to a group of people together. Of the people who come, Tracy, I don't know if there's I don't need an exact statistic or whatever, but by your impression, how many people come to something like this who have already kind of bought into it, and how many people come to it who are really curious about something that they might be a bit skeptical about?
I would say it's depending on the group, because some of it's like the employer says, hey, everybody's coming. I think there is a good number of people in each group who have gone through some type of trainings or workshops, but there's still plenty of people who not really sure what they're getting into, but it seems like maybe one person, two people a year don't get anything out of it, which I think is a pretty, pretty good outcome.
Rebecca, what about your perception of the people who might come to this event? What would you tell somebody who is, who maybe doesn't understand the point, or maybe is a little bit skeptical, might even be a little bit resistant to the idea that they live in a world of privilege?
Yeah, I think, you know, it's the same thing I would tell anybody. Our purpose, you know, or I should say, like, one of our guiding principles in offering this is, and really in having any of these conversations, is to come with a learner's mindset. You know, Tracy and I, we've facilitated together multiple times, and you know, we often start out saying, you know, we're not experts on this. We're here learning with you. And while we have some really good information and some, you know, frames of reference and some lenses that we're going to offer people to look at the world through, it's really all about who shows up in that space, having that conversation about this topic. And that's really one of my favorite parts of the workshop, is every single group is different. Every single workshop is different, because it's all depends on who shows up and what they're bringing to the conversation. I will say, as we've been collecting surveys, you know, we've done the workshop now, I think almost, I haven't done the exact tally from this last year, but we've done probably about 200 people in the La Crosse area have now gone through the workshop. And of people who've responded to our surveys, we're running at about 90% of people who would recommend this to somebody else. And that means, you know, and that's people coming from, you know, we've had people who are trainers themselves, who do this for a living as well, to people who have never had a formal conversation about race or racism. So I would encourage anybody, if you can come with an open mind, you're gonna get something out of this to take with you.
I mentioned just as an example, setting up this question, somebody who might be resistant to the idea of privilege, and it reminded me that we didn't talk about that concept in the previous half of our conversation. So I want to bring it up in a few, you know, we've got some time here. I know a lot of people who are resistant to that idea, because the La Crosse area is full of people who might have grown up in an agricultural community, or people who grew up with parents who had industrial jobs and maybe didn't make very much money, people who grew up in, you know, government subsidized housing, on food stamps, those kinds of things, and here we are telling them that they grew up in some sort of privileged environment, and they would take great issue with that, some of them. How do you explain the concept of privilege to people who didn't grow up in upper middle class families with lots and lots of access?
Well, it's funny that you talk about our rural roots here in the La Crosse area. I grew up on a farm myself and come from that working family background. And I'm going to steal another anti-racism facilitator's quote around privilege. And this is what I use in my own life, my own guiding post for when I look at privilege that I experience is it doesn't mean having privilege doesn't mean that your life isn't hard. It just means that the color of your skin and how other people perceive you because of that makes it harder. And I don't know if Tracy would have anything to add to that, but that's the lens that I use when I look at privilege and kind of how am I walking through the world, and does the way that I'm perceived by other people based on my light skin, my European ancestry, how does that impact me? Does that open doors for me that wouldn't open doors for other people? And just to pay attention to that.
Tracy, how do you want people to perceive this issue of privilege?
Well, one thing that I like to do with people is, because I know there's this knee-jerk reaction when we say white privilege. And I will add that, there's not just white privilege. There's all kinds of privilege. I have the privilege myself of being an American citizen. I have the privilege of being an English first speaker. Lots of people, when they're talking about I struggle too, blah, 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 you are a part of the groups that did not have the economic or class privilege that other people have had. So everybody has privileges. Everybody are part of the groups that have been oppressed by the people with privilege. And much like what Rebecca said, it's not a competition on who had it worse. It's just the fact that because of the history, the policies, Jim Crow laws, all of these different laws, if you could see all of the policies and laws that affect specific communities of color, you'd be floored. But those are what created these barriers that keep us from having the opportunities as easily as people who are white. It's also the fact that, hey, it's a lot easier to go shopping around here if you're white. You're not going to find all the shades of color for makeup. You may not find all of the clothing designs that fit all the different body types, hair products, skin products. If you're not a person of color, you don't see that. And I remember as a kid trying to color with a crayon that said flesh and knowing that did not look like me or my dad, but it said it was flesh, and now it's peach, So it's also that privilege of not struggling to find things for you as a white person. Native people, we have some different shapes. A lot of us have something, our feet are, I don't want to say fatter, they're wider. Nike actually created a shoe that was targeted to us because it was designed for our feet. It's these little things that people don't even think about. Like, I can go get a Band-Aid, it's going to match my skin. It's only been in the last maybe two decades that other people in other communities of color are able to find these things that are also designed for them.
Well, I've certainly enjoyed our conversation today. I want to thank both of you for being here. Tracy, thank you for sharing so many of your personal experiences and also for talking to us about the workshop and what people can experience. Thank you very much.
It's been great being here. Thank you, Ezra.
And Rebecca, thank you for being here. I want to give you an opportunity before we go to give some information on where and how people can get signed up if they're interested in attending the workshop on the 30th through the 1st.
Yeah, I would love to. And again, thanks for the invitation today. You can go to check out our Facebook page. They can message us directly on our Facebook page or email me, rschwartz@ywcalax.org. here in La Crosse for information. I can share the link with you, but it's a little more complicated to share on the air, so I won't try to read that to you.
So the best thing other than your email address might be to look for YWCA La Crosse on Facebook.
Yes.
We've been joined by Rebecca Schwartz and Tracy Littlejohn talking about the upcoming racial justice workshop from the YWCA. If you'd like to hear part of this conversation again, you can find it on our website, which is wpr.org/newsmakers. If you got a comment for the show or a question that you'd like us to delve into at a future conversation, hit us up via email, which is newsmakers@wpr.org. That's newsmakers@wpr.org. The program continues in just a moment. This is Newsmakers from Wisconsin Public Radio.
Welcome to Newsmakers. I'm Gene Purcell. State government is on the road in Wisconsin. Once a year or so, state officials hit the road and take the state capital somewhere other than Madison. This year, the state capital is moving down the Mississippi River and making a stop here in La Crosse. Our guest today on Newsmakers is Wisconsin Governor Tommy Thompson. And our panelists today include Sandra Harris with WLSU.
That's, of course, longtime WLSU and WPR manager Gene Purcell. Introducing Newsmakers on a show way back in the day before he moved to Madison and worked for the Educational Communications Board and eventually became the director of Wisconsin Public Media, which is our parent organization. Gene Purcell passed away recently, and we all miss him already and always will. I'm Ezra Wall, the current host of Newsmakers, and I'm glad you're joining us today to remember Gene fondly, as we always do. And joining me to help in that effort is Dean Kallenbach, who was the senior regional manager for Wisconsin Public Radio till very recently, and was a colleague of Gene's for a long, long time. Dean, thanks for taking some time with us today.
Glad to be with you, Ezra. Thank you.
So you knew Gene from way back before WLSU, which is one of our local stations in La Crosse that Newsmakers runs on, before WLSU was even part of Wisconsin Public Radio. When did you first get acquainted with Gene?
Would have been in the early 90s. I had just been appointed regional manager for Wisconsin Public Radio stations in the western part of the state. That includes WHLA in La Crosse. Because WLSU, which was the public radio outlet based in La Crosse, was an independent station, and Gene worked for that organization. Jim Conway was the station manager back in those early 90s. Bob Sequist was the program director, and then Gene and others were involved in the news department, people like Sandra Harris and John Davis, and Steve Royson. But Gene was the news director at the time that I first met him. And I would make sure just to stop in as a matter of collegiality whenever I was in La Crosse. I'd stop into the offices at UW La Crosse and visit with Jim and Bob and Gene and got to have a good relationship with them and chatted about things that, ways we might collaborate in the future and that sort of thing. So I always found Gene to be collegial and I knew his work before that he's just a darn good reporter and a good newsman.
I first came in contact with Gene a year or so before I ended up working at WPR, and he was very, very cordial and always enjoyed exchanging an email now and then about what life in La Crosse is or was like. Mm-hmm. And then I had the privilege of getting to work with him for the last 18 months or so, which has been really great, and I regret that time doesn't get to continue into the future, but I didn't know Gene in the early days of his career, and John Davis, whom you've already mentioned is a longtime reporter and producer here at WPR, he found in the audio archives of the Murphy Library, UWL's library, he found an oral history interview that Gene did back in 1991 when he was the program director at WLSU, and he described some of his early days in radio and kind of how he got started. Let's listen.
My radio story started in 1979 when I started working at WLSU. At that time, I was a student And I was a mass communication student, and my dad suggested that since this was a jazz station, he was a jazz fan, it might be a good idea for me to work here part-time and get some practical experience. That lasted for I worked here for a couple of years at WLSU, and then I got my first part-time job in commercial broadcasting at WLCX, which was 1490 AM at that time, and they had a FM, WLXR FM, which was FM 105, it was a country station. And I worked there till they were bought, and they switched hands in September of 83, and I continued working at what then became Hit 105 and 15 Country. I worked as an announcer, and I wound up staying there until December 31st, 1985, when I was replaced by a machine. Then I came back to WLSU, and up until then I'd just been an announcer until 1986. And I did some part-time news at WLCX because I needed the money. They did a lot of news then, and so they always needed bodies. So I did some part-time news, and I turned that into a job here at WLSU. And I worked as a reporter here for 3 years, news director for two, and now I've been program director for about 6 months.
So there's Gene, then the program director of WLSU, Gene Purcell. Of course, today on Newsmakers, we're remembering Gene because he passed away recently. And we're remembering his legacy and his impact on all of us at WPR, but really his impact on so many listeners who still remember him. I am amazed by the number of people. You know, in radio, once you're gone, you're kind of just gone. The people
not
who,
in public radio.
The people who remember Gene, I mean, remember him like he just left. And it was 15 years ago when he left lacrosse. And it's been just amazing. When you got to know him, and then later when you became colleagues, was it evident even at that time the quiet charisma that a lot of people have reflected on?
Yeah, it's an interesting thing because you know, Gene is only he's about 2 years my junior. I think he's 61 years old, and I'm 63. But we both came into radio at a time when automation systems were starting to kind of become more prevalent, and station managers in commercial radio were seeing, oh, this is a way we can make more money and spend less money by having fewer employees. You know, that I'm sure, I know it impacted me, and I'm sure it impacted Gene in a similar way, in that we understood that the magic of radio, the thing that made it important to people, was that ability to be one-on-one, to connect on a person-to-person basis. The reason that Gene, I think, and this is my conjecture, but the reason I think Gene was such a successful broadcaster is because that sort of one-on-one mentality was always a part of who he was. He wasn't a person who sought to stand and speak before 10,000 people or 100 people. He wanted to have a conversation. He wanted to have one-on-one conversations. He did that on the radio very effectively. And the reason I think he was so effective on the radio is that he was such a good conversationalist in all aspects of his life. One of the things that made him a great conversationalist was that he was a good listener. I mean, he wasn't constantly interjecting his own opinion and stories. He was drawing you out, which made him a great interviewer as well, of course. And again, that may have been a developed skill. I didn't know Gene early in his career. My sense is this has always been a part of his personality, because you would see it in the recent years when he was in a management situation, and the accolades I've seen from my fellow Wisconsin Public Radio colleagues who've talked about the impact he had on their lives. So much of it was that one-on-one individual contact. And I know that was the case in his interactions in the La Crosse area and the Cooley region, that he just had so many relationships he had built up through newsmakers, through the reporting that he had done, through his work as a program director, but also through his activity in the community, whether it was curling club or whatever it might be. He was just a guy who enjoyed interacting with individuals. He wasn't a big crowds guy, you know, at all times. He grew into being really good at that, but that wasn't his bag. His bag was talking to individuals, getting to know them one-on-one, and caring about who they were.
your closest association with Gene began really when WLSU merged with Wisconsin Public Radio, and Gene eventually became the regional manager here in the La Crosse area, taking on WHLA, which you had previously managed along yes. with WLSU. What was that like, kind of getting that system of regional stations, regional sort of broadcast pods, if you will, of groups of stations set up? Because WPR as a statewide network is kind of unique in the way that it does that.
Yeah, we started organizing as regional offices. Well, the regional bureau started in 1986. I was one of the original hires. I was the original reporter and morning host for Western Wisconsin. And we also started bureaus in Stevens Point. That bureau is now in Wausau. We had a bureau in Green Bay. We had a bureau in Appleton. We had a bureau in Milwaukee, and eventually had a bureau in Superior. The idea was that we would do a better job of representing the people of the region if we had bodies in the region. Makes total sense. Still kind of revolutionary at the time, and at a time when a lot of media organizations were centralizing, Wisconsin Public Radio chose to decentralize. Jack Mitchell was the director of Wisconsin Public Radio, and that was kind of his baby. Jack, by the way, this month is going to be inducted in the Wisconsin Broadcasters Hall of Fame. But the idea was, you know, boots on the ground make a difference. And having people in the community who are part of the community, part of community organizations, are able to have those conversations, that was really important. And so I was really excited when we were able to connect with WLSU and with Gene and his staff, because they had already established that in that community. And there was no way I could represent from Eau Claire. I could represent WHLA, the big Ideas Network station in La Crosse. I couldn't do that as well from Eau Claire as somebody in La Crosse could. So it was great to be able to hand that over to Gene and have him be a part of that and get the assets and the listeners and the history of WLSU and its strong journalistic and cultural history that it had in the community.
Now you worked with Gene. Gene worked for you initially, coming on board when you were senior regional manager, and he was regional manager here in La Crosse. And then the tables turned over time. He went and spent about a decade with the Educational Communications Board, and then in 2018-ish, he came back to WPR as the head of Wisconsin Public Media, yep. which oversees Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin. So you've known Gene, the supervisee, and Gene, the supervisor. Right. Any difference between those two?
Yeah, the supervisor wore a tie. The supervisee never did, almost never did.
The supervisor wore a tie once a year when he went to the legislature, from what I heard.
Yeah, that's pretty much true. But yeah, I think I remember Gene calling me. He was first appointed to the Educational Communications Board. It was by the director at the time, Wendy Wink. He was going to be the deputy director. And he called me and he said, "Hey, you know, she's asked me to do this. What do you think?" I said, "I think it's a great opportunity for you, but I think you're going to have to wear a tie." And despite that, he took the job, and it worked out fine. But his standard uniform, you know, that I remember him as regional manager was just open collar shirt and a cardigan. You know, he probably didn't wear it in the summertime, but that's what I remember him in. And many of the pictures I have of those days, that's exactly the attire he wore. But I think Gene himself would be if you took him in 1991 during that interview and you fast forwarded it to, you know, this last year, for instance, and say, okay, you know, here's what you're going to be doing now. I think he would both be amazed and surprised at how effective he could be in that managerial role. And part of it was that he made that, he didn't try to be something he wasn't. He continued to be Gene. He continued to use those skills of one-on-one communication. He continued to use those listening skills. And he was simply able to convert them into the stuff that you need to be to run a large organization, in, including the ability to speak with legislators, to speak with administration in the University of Wisconsin-Madison, which is our home base, or, you know, where we're based. And also to speak across partnerships with the Educational Communications Board, which of course he had directed. So he had great relationships built there with Marta Bechtol, who was his deputy director, is now the director of ECB, and all the staff there. I mean, he had great love among those folks as well. And we're seeing outpouring of affection from folks from ECB as well, but all the other Wisconsin public media partners as well. And there are tons of them. He's just comfortable moving within those circles. And he was, he was Gene. And because of that, he was approachable. And because of that, he made partners and potential partners who might otherwise be reluctant to work with us much more comfortable, because they knew that Gene was a person of his word. And, you know, if he gave a promise, it was going to happen. And that was true of employees, that was true of partners, and that was true of even legislators, I think.
Speaking of that transition from local management of WLSU and then multiple WPR stations up to the top of the organization in Madison, rather presciently, I think, during the oral history interview from Murphy Library that we played a clip from earlier, he talked about the difficulty of running an independent public radio station in a town like La Crosse. Really, the financial burden of it is what it comes down to, the difficulty in fundraising, the changing funding model that was affecting them even at that time. And let's listen to this clip, because he kind of predicts what eventually happened, which is a small independent station like WLSU would need to affiliate with somebody like WPR in order to keep the doors open. Let's listen to Gene Purcell.
No longer function. If we lose our federal funding, we will not be able to function in the way we are now. I don't see us going off the air, per se. Somebody's going to keep this frequency on. It might be Wisconsin Public Radio has been expressing an interest in this station for many years. But if we went broke and we couldn't afford to operate, Wisconsin Public Radio or somebody else would have an interest in it. So it's not going to go away. But as the funding changes, it might change. Now, I don't know. I don't think things are any more dire this year than they have been in the past. But it's not getting any easier. Mm-hmm. Funding is always a problem.
That's Gene Purcell, a former reporter and DJ and news director and program director and station manager here in La Crosse at WLSU, which is, of course, part of Wisconsin Public Radio now. Gene went on to be the regional manager of Wisconsin Public Radio here in La Crosse, and eventually on to head our whole organization, and we're all going to miss him very much. Gene passed away recently. Joining me today, Dean Kallenbach, who was until recently the senior regional manager of Wisconsin Public Radio. Dean is now spending more time feeding chickens and keeping bees, and I really appreciate you joining me today to talk about a little bit about Gene. And I hope to see you soon and catch up about him in person.
You bet.
Gene has a couple of celebrations of life organized by his wife, Ruth, and other family and friends. On August 29th, there will be a celebration of Gene's life in Madison. But the pertinent details to our listeners here in La Crosse is that on September 4th, there will be a celebration of life for Gene Purcell at the Pump House downtown. That's from 2 to 6 on Saturday, the 4th of September. And the festivities go from 2 to 6, and they really will be festivities as we celebrate Gene Purcell. There will be a presentation, more formal part of the program, beginning at 4 o'clock. That's going to be the 4th at the Pump House. And I certainly hope to see you there. There are a couple of times each week you can catch Newsmakers. Our show originates 10 a.m. on Friday on the Ideas Network 90.3. And then we repeat at 7 o'clock on Friday evening on 88.9 WLSU, Gene's old station. And speaking of Gene, let's end today's show by hearing Gene do what he did best and liked probably the most, which is DJ some jazz. Gene, take it away.
Lionel Hampton's coming up next here at WLSU Lacrosse, and this was from a compilation CD called The Jump and Jive, the All-Star Groups. Pretty old, too, actually, 1937 to 1939, but it holds up very well. And this is something that Lionel Hampton co-wrote. It's called Shufflin' at the Hollywood, Take One.